From PRX, this is The Moth Radio Hour. I'm Sarah Austin-Jeunesse from The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. At The Moth, people tell true stories from their lives. They stand on stage in bars, clubs, and theaters, and they tell these stories without notes to audiences all around the country. This hour, we'll have three stories for you. A stakeout leads a cop to a strange exchange with a criminal's mother. A teenager rebels after her brother is disowned. And our first story from stand-up comic Tig Notaro. Tig told the story at a Moth night we produced along with KCRW in Los Angeles. The theme was Carpe Diem, stories of our most vital moments. Now, Tig is a comedian, but this story is on the serious side. So, Tig, people who know that you told a Moth story say, I bet her story is so funny. And they haven't heard it yet.
Well, I do feel like it's the funniest story I've ever told.
Okay, just get that out there. All right.
Yeah, some of my strongest jokes in there. It was such an amazingly fun challenge for me. The process was totally different than what I normally do. The story was not hilarious. There were moments where I got laughs. But the process of pulling the story together was just me writing out just free form and then running it past you and trying to find structure and weed out things and then having to long distance over the phone tell the story to you and not rely on my notes or outline at all. Was really good for me to do. Just in stand-up, I'll just get a concept and go on stage with just one word, and I will just do it over and over with The Moth. It was, I don't know, just pulling it together and then getting on stage and being really curious how it was going to go.
We'll hear more of my conversation with Tig after her story. For now, from Los Angeles, here's Tig Notaro live at The Moth.
So when I was little, I made a mess of my room like any other child my age. The difference between me and other kids was the person overseeing my cleanup was my stepfather, Rick. And Rick was an attorney and in the military. He was very stoic, removed, emotionless. And I used to joke and say that he was kind of like C-3PO, but with less emotion. And then it dawned on me recently that that joke actually doesn't make any sense. Because C-3PO is very emotional. Just like, Atu, where are you? You know? Like, my stepfather was never in a panic looking for me the way C-3PO was looking for R2. So, cleaning up my room, I was given an allotted time, and Rick would come in, and whatever was out of place, he would put in a large trash bag, and then he'd lock it in the trunk of the car. Then I had to do chores to earn money to buy my toys back. I know, it sounds harsh, because it is. But to be fair, I could buy. They were priced fairly. Like they were. I could buy entire Millennium Falcons, wind up Evel Knievels, and stuffed monkeys for like a nickel each. Totally reasonable. But Rick, what he was hardcore. Like, holidays, we weren't even allowed to have friends or family over the house. He claimed our house was not big enough. So that was not true.
Meanwhile, my mother was very emotional and passionate and affectionate. She was wild and funny. She's originally from southern Mississippi and was raised in a very conservative house. And she was always just wanting to make sure that I knew the most important thing in life was to be happy. And she just supported anything I did. Anything I did was so cool, and I always looked adorable, and just everything was great, you know? And like even down to dropping out of high school, my mother would brag to people. She's like, yeah, Tig dropped out, you know? She's doing her own thing. And my own thing, I had nothing going on. Like, I was like working at a pizza parlor or selling po' boys. That was me doing my own thing. And but then I found stand-up comedy. And I immediately had focus in my life. And I was so passionate and excited about it. And my mother, you know, she didn't care if I was in some dingy club in middle America or on TV. She just thought I was cool, you know, as long as I was happy, she was happy. Rick, Rick told me that my career was a waste of my time and a waste of my intelligence. And he thought that I should be a doctor or a lawyer. He suggested that I quit comedy and go to business school. Like, even just a couple of years ago, when my career was going fine, I was making good money. I said, so you're telling me if I quit comedy and went to business school, something I'm not at all interested in, and ended up working in like a cubicle in an office somewhere with the life sucked out of me, you would support that? And he said, absolutely. I was like, wow, okay. So, although my mother was very supportive of me, we certainly had our differences and problems. And I remember one time, like a decade ago, being on the phone, fighting. And when the argument wasn't going anywhere, when I was mid-sentence, she just abruptly handed the phone to Rick. And he said, Tig, your mother doesn't want to talk to you. And he just hung up on me. And I kept calling back, no answer. It was so frustrating and stifling. And this March, my phone rang, and the word parents popped up on my caller ID. And I was like, oh, this is probably my mother calling to wish me a happy birthday, because a couple of days before it was my birthday and I had missed her call. And when I answered the phone, it was Rick. And Rick has only called me like 2 times in my entire life. One was to tell me, I have no idea what that was about. And the second time was this time, and he was calling to tell me that my mother had fallen and hit her head and was not gonna make it. And I immediately pictured her lying in a hospital, just barely hanging on, saying, you know, call Tig, tell her to come to Texas to say goodbye. And I said, can I talk to my mother? You know, put her on the phone. He said, no, you can't ever talk to her again. My mother had suffered massive brain hemorrhaging with zero chance of recovery. And it was really so intense to process that I would never be able to talk to her again. I've reflected a lot recently about that phone call over a decade ago when we were arguing. And I've thought about how I know my mother would give anything in the world to be able to come back to talk to me. And I always think that if somebody could be like, okay, you can come back, but you have to come back to that phone call where you're fighting with Tig, there would be zero fighting. It would be only I love yous and I'm sorrys from both of us. After my mother's funeral, we left Mississippi, our hometown where she was buried, and we were driving back to Texas. And my brother and my uncle were in one car, and Rick and I were in the other. And we were driving, and he said, Tig, I want to talk to you about something. And I was like, oh, great. What could this, be? Not in the mood. And he said, I wanted to talk to you about that time that you said that I hurt your feelings. The time that I hurt your feelings when I told you you should go to business school. And I said, oh, yeah. That hurt my feelings, but what really hurt my feelings was telling me my career was a waste of my time and a waste of my intelligence. That was hurtful. And he said, and he started to cry. The robot started to cry. And he said, I was wrong, and I wanted to apologize for that. He said that I never understood you as a child. I didn't get you at all. And I tried to project onto you my life and my route, and I expected you to take that exact same route. And I'm realizing that it's not the child's responsibility to teach the parent who they are. It's the parent's responsibility to learn who the child is. And I didn't do that. And I'm sorry. And I said, so, and I'm crying too. I said, are you saying that if I said I was going to quit comedy and go to business school, you wouldn't support that anymore? And he said, absolutely not. He said, that is the only thing in the world that you should be doing. I was like, oh my gosh. I didn't even realize that I needed that so desperately to hear that. And the only thing that really bums me out is that my mother wasn't there to hear that, to hear him tell me that. This Thanksgiving, I went to Texas, and we actually spent it with Rick's side of the family. And I needed to get away and just be by myself, and I decided to drive to my mother and Rick's house. And when I pulled up into the driveway, I just had a full-on breakdown, just sobbing in the driveway. Because I was like, oh my gosh, my mother is not in that house. And of course I knew that, but it just really hit me in the driveway. And then I walked inside, and the house still smelled like her. And everything was just so quiet. I was just looking around, and still photos that were framed just seemed so still. Just moments in time caught and just gone forever. And all the photos were still just placed where my mother had placed them over the years. And I started opening drawers because I wanted to just see something of my mother. She would write little notes to herself, like, you know, Dennis, 2 p.m. tomorrow. And she was an artist. And she would sketch me perfectly on a napkin when I was just sitting around. And so was just looking for those kinds of things in the drawers, and there wasn't anything in there, and I went to open a closet, and there's nothing there, and I was finding nothing in any drawers or closets, and I just started going around the house, just running around, just trying to find something, and then I was in this panic and just crying even harder. Like, Rick had gutted the house out like he had when I was a child with a trash bag. Everything was gone. And I was like, I'm done with this person. I couldn't believe I had fallen for that conversation. And I was so ready to write him off immediately. I was done. And I called him on my cell phone. And he said, "Hello, Tig, how are you doing?" I said, "Not good. Not good. All of my mother's things are gone. And so are my childhood things." And he said, "Oh, hold on a minute. Go into my bedroom. Go into my closet." And he started directing me. And I was like, "Yeah." He said, "Look at the top shelf." And up there, he had placed some of my mother's things and some of my childhood things. And, I opened the box, and she was a dancer too. There were her ballet slippers and photos, and I just was like, "You're lucky." And although, before March, when the word parents popped up on my caller ID, it represented my mother and Rick. Now, when the word parents pops up on my caller ID, it's only Rick. We have very different cleanup techniques. But I'm learning to get used to that. So, good night.
That was Tig Notaro. Tig is a stand-up comic. She has a popular podcast called Professor Blastoff, and she also writes for film and TV. This Moth story is actually included as a bonus track on her CD called Live. I talked with Tig after she told her story. I have to tell you, whenever I see an R2-D2 something, I think of you.
So, I would hope so.
So, for example, I saw an R2-D2 Vespa the other day, and I thought perhaps you would like that. There was also a hat that made me think of you. So let's just get that out of the way.
So you thought of me twice, basically.
That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
That's funny.
So does Rick know that you told this story?
No. No, he doesn't. I'm not keeping it from him. I maybe it'll come up. I just haven't felt compelled to be like calling him up and saying, "Hi, I talked about you." I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he'll hear it.
Yeah.
He follows everything I do now. I think. Unless he's lost interest recently. Like, "Oh, you know what? She's actually not that good. She's not as good as I thought."
Does he still call you every Sunday? You said he was on a kick.
Well, there. I mean, he's still calling me regularly. I think the Sunday thing has not stayed as a pattern. But, you know, he called me yesterday. I called him back today. And so we're definitely in touch.
To hear more of my interview with Tig, go to themoth.org. In a moment, we'll be back with a story from a veteran cop on the emotional toll of stakeouts.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Next up is Steve Osborne, a former New York City cop. Steve has told a bunch of stories at the Moth. Maybe you've heard him before on the Moth Radio Hour. He's one of those rare people for whom the events of almost every day could be crafted into a story. He's just a natural raconteur. He told this at a Moth show called Crack Up, Stories of Comedy and Calamity. And yes, his accent is for real. Here's Steve Osborne, live at the Moth.
How you doing? My name's Steve Osborne. I was a New York City cop for 20 years. Now, a few years back, I was a sergeant in the Fugitive Division. Now, our job was to go out and hunt down and catch the most wanted fugitives. This was the greatest job in the world. I love this stuff. I used to love hunting these guys down, tracking them down wherever they would try and hide. You know, we'd find them, we'd catch them, jump them, handcuff them, and drag them in. It was loads of fun. I once tracked a guy down to the maternity ward while his wife was giving birth. Now, before you go ooh and ah and all of that, he shot 5 people. When you start shooting that many people, I'll get you wherever I can get you. You know, all's fair. Now, we would start work at 4:30 in the morning, and I would come in, and the reason that we did that was because we wanted to catch you in bed, sleeping. You were tired, you were groggy, and you were less likely to go for a gun or a knife or try something else stupid. Now, when we would come into work, I'd grab my coffee, I'd sit at my desk, and there'd be a stack of warrants on my desk, like 5, 6, 7 of them, the guys that we were going after that day. And they'd usually be in priority order. The worst guy would be on top. Now, the guy on top this day was this kid by the name of Hector. Now, at the age of 26, Hector was already a hardcore bad guy. He'd been locked up a whole load of times, everything from, like, smoking weed to assault to robbery, criminal possession of a weapon, and his latest collar, an attempted murder. That was the one that I was concerned with. Turns out he gets into a beef with a guy, pulls out a gun, and shoots him. The guy didn't die, so attempted murder. He gets arrested. You know, he goes through the system, and he goes to his arraignment, and the Bronx being the Bronx, the judge lets him out on bail with a return date of 30 days later. Well, surprise, surprise. 30 days comes and goes, and Hector's nowhere to be found. Judge gets pissed off, issues a warrant for his arrest. Now he's my problem. Now I got to go find him and bring him in. Now, every warrant that comes, it comes in a package. There's the warrant itself, signed off by the judge. There's all the guy's arrest reports. And stapled on top is a mugshot. Now, you all seen police mugshots, you know, the guy standing there with, you know, with the numbers across his chest. It's the worst possible photo that anybody could ever take. I don't think Pamela Anderson topless could take a good mugshot. You know, maybe her, but really, I don't think anybody else. So I'm looking at this kid's photo, and he's sitting there, and he's looking at me, you know, he's got the numbers across his chest and the profile with the numbers. And he's got these, and I could just tell by looking at him. I've been doing this for a long time. I made hundreds and hundreds of arrests, and I could just tell by looking at this kid's face, he is going to be a pain in the ass. He had these little black beady eyes staring at me, and he had these high bony cheekbones and his pointy chin and his scraggly goatee and his pockmarked face, and he had a scar under his eye. It looked like he had gotten cut in a fight. Believe me, it was a face that only a mother could love. So now it's time to get to work. So I go through my checklist. You know, I got my vest, gun, backup gun, handcuffs, flashlight, all the tools of the trade. You know, everything you need for hunting down bad guys. So I get my team together. I got 6 very talented detectives, and we head out the door. And I got that spring in my step, like, I love this stuff. So we head over to his building. Real bad building. I mean, I've been there a couple times before. Every time we go there, there's always a problem. Either they're throwing bricks and bottles off the roof at us, or perps are fighting with us. It's always a problem. But it was early in the morning, and everything was quiet, so I was hoping to slip in, get this guy, and get the hell out before anybody even knew we were there. We go through the front door, we go into the lobby, and it's a dump. There's bullet holes in the wall, there's graffiti on the walls, there's crack vials on the floor, empty beer bottles, urine in the corner. The place is a mess. So he lives in apartment 4B. So we figure out the B apartments face front. So I tell two of my guys, cover the front window. Now you might think, like, who would jump out a fourth floor window and try to escape? But I'm telling you, desperate men do desperate things. And I guarantee you, if he jumps out that window and kills himself, his family's going to be on the 6 o'clock news that night, swearing to God that I threw him out the window, and trying to sue the city for $50 million. So two guys covering the window might save me a little bit of aggravation. We go up to the apartment, and it's like it's choreographed. We do this every day. I take one side of the door, one of my guys takes the other side of the door, and we listen. And we're listening for anything, you know, voices, TV, radio play, and kids, a dog barking, anything that might give us a clue, you know, what we're walking into. So we listen for a minute, nothing, everything's quiet. So it's time to hit this thing. Now, the last thing I always do before we hit a warrant is I take the mugshot out, and I study it. You know, I look at that face, and you just commit it to memory. Because a lot of times you go into these apartments, it's dark, there could be a lot of confusion, the family may be fighting with us, somebody could be going for a gun or a knife, and there may be a brother, a cousin, an uncle, a nephew, somebody that looks just like them, so you want to know exactly what your bad guy looks like. So I take out the photo, and I'm studying it, and I'm looking at it, and I see them little black beady eyes staring at me, and that pockmarked face, and that goatee, and that bony cheekbones, and that bony chin, and the scar under his eye. So I take the photo, and I hand it off to the next guy. He does the same thing. Everybody passes it around, and I stick it back in my pocket. Now it's time to hit this thing. Now you might think that we knock the door down, but we really don't. We knock. You know, if I have to, you know, I got a battering ram and sledgehammers and stuff in the car. I'll go down and get it, and I'll knock your door down. But usually knocking works. So I knock on the door. Listening, nothing. I knock a little louder, knock a little louder. Finally, I hear a woman's voice on the other side of the door. You know, who is it? What do you want? So we tell her, police, we got a warrant. Open the door. So I hear on the other side of the door, click, 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 click. You know, she's got like 20 locks on this door. As she's doing that, you know, we're turning on our flashlights, we're unholstering our guns, and we're getting ready. The door opens up, and there's this little Hispanic woman standing there with this pink, fluffy robe and these little pink, fluffy slippers. She's like late 40s, early 50s. And I tell her, I says, police, we got a warrant, we're coming in. And we kind of push our way past her. So we go into the apartment and we do our thing. And we're going from room to room. We're tearing the place apart. You know, we're flipping up beds. We're tearing clothes out of the closets. And the reason that you do this is because these guys will hide in the most, on the tiniest, most unbelievable places. So you got to be thorough. So we're tearing the place apart looking for them. No sign of them. I go back out to the living room and I grab Mom. And I says, Ma, I says, where's Hector? I got to talk to him. And she looks at me with this kind of like confused look on her face. And she says to me, she goes, my son's dead. So my first reaction is, bullshit, don't lie to me. You might think that I'm being a hard, but I'm not. Believe me when I tell you, I've had little old ladies with rosary beads and Bibles in their hands swearing to God that they haven't seen their little Johnny in months. Meanwhile, the behind the bedroom door with a butcher knife waiting for us to come in. You know, it's dangerous work, and I trust nobody. So I tell her, I says, look, you're not helping him. Tell me where he is. Don't make me hunt him down out in the street. That's how things happen. Tell me where he is, or get him to turn himself in. With that, the daughter comes out of the bedroom, and she grabs her mother, and they kind of like interlock their arms, and they're kind of like hugging each other. They're scared. They're nervous. You know, it's understandable. The cops are busted in their house early in the morning, tearing the place apart. So I says to the girl, I says, where's your brother? I got to talk to him. And she looks right at me, and she goes, my brother's dead. She goes, he was shot and killed last week down the block. And with that, she goes over to the refrigerator, and she gets his business card, and she hands it to me. And she says, here, talk to this detective. He's got the case. He knows everything. So I take the card and I hand it to one of my guys. I says, make a call. So we make a couple of phone calls. And sure enough, everything checks out. Hector was a homicide victim. About a week earlier, he got shot and killed down the block. So everything checks out. So I tell Mom, I says, look, I'm very sorry for your loss. I'm very sorry the way we had to bust in the way we did, but, you know, we had a warrant, and this is the way we do things. And I go on to explain to her, I says, look, I'll go down to court, I'll get the warrant vacated, I'll make sure that nobody comes and bothers you again. I'm very sorry. And with that, it's time for us to go. You know, in reality, I got 5 or 6 more Hectors we're going after that morning. But before we leave, I take the mugshot out of my pocket. Just want to make sure. There's no mistaken identity. You know, we're talking about the same kid. We're in the right apartment. So I take the mugshot and I show it to her. And I says, is this your son? She takes one look at the photo and tears just start rolling down her face. And she starts sobbing. Like that really like deep, mournful sob like only a mother, like crying over her child would. So, I believe her. I mean, obviously, this is her son. This is the apartment. You know, we're all on the same page. We're all talking about the same kid. So I take the photo. I stick it back in my pocket. And I tell her again, look, I'm very sorry for your loss. And we turn to leave. And as I turn to leave, she says to me, can I see the picture again? Now I'm a little bit confused. I'm like, this picture? Now I'm confused. I'm like, didn't she get a good look at it before? Is she not sure? I'm not sure where this thing is going now. So I take the photo out, and I show it to her. And she reaches out, and she takes it from my hand, and she clutches it to her chest. And it's like she was hugging him. And she says to me, can I keep this picture? So I'm like, that picture? You want to keep that picture? So I tell her, I says, look, you know, it's police department property. I says, we don't normally give them out to the public. You know, we don't hand these things out as souvenirs. So she goes on to tell me this story that she has no photos of him. He was never around. You know, when his whole adult life, he was either out tearing up the streets or he was in jail. He never really came around for Mother's Day or Christmas or anything like that. And she had no photos of him. She had nothing to remember him by. So when she tells me this story, I feel terrible for her. You know, I'm like a hardcore guy, but my heart's breaking for her a little bit. You know, and she seemed like a nice lady. I mean, this building was a dump. And the apartment, she kept it clean. You know, she put that thick plastic on the sofa, you know. So that, you know, wouldn't get dirty. And she wasn't cursing me out like a lot of other mothers do, you know, blaming me because their son's got a warrant and he's got to go back to jail. She just seemed like a nice lady who lost her son to the streets, which in that neighborhood happened a lot. So I told her, I says, okay. I says, if you got nothing else to remember this kid by, go ahead, be my guest, it's yours. And she reaches out, she shakes my hand, and she's thanking me. And with that, she's clutching her robe shut, and she had those little pink fluffy slippers, and she shuffles across the room. And she goes over to this bookcase against the wall that had all these family photos, you know, in these nice silver and gold frames. You know, there was Grandpa in his World War II uniform, and wedding photos, and graduation pictures, you know, with the cap and the gown. And very lovingly and very tenderly, like only a mother would do, she took that mugshot and she placed it right in the middle of those family photos. Thank you very much.
That was Steve Osborne. Steve was a New York City police officer for 20 years and retired as a lieutenant assigned to the Detective Bureau. For a photo of Steve on the job, and for extras related to all the stories you hear on the Moth Radio Hour, go to themoth.org. After this break, our final story. A high school student stands up to her mother after her oldest brother, her idol, is cast out of the family.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. Thank you.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse from The Moth. Our final storyteller is Shawit Zirai. Shawit was a junior in high school when she told this story. She was part of a Moth Shop community education program. That's the series where we teach storytelling workshops to high school students and adults in community groups. We've had a great response to these high school storytelling classes. Lots of teenagers have developed personal stories with The Moth. And I asked Shawit why she thinks that is.
I think a lot of it has to do with the idea of, I guess, lack of voice. You know, everyone's talking about how our generation doesn't have a voice, and that's very cliched, but it's like, it's true. You know, we don't have any kind of centralized thought process. We are all very unique, and we all like to believe we're very unique. And I think this kind of free form, like, it's not that it's not a lot of work. It's a lot of work that you want to do. This is something that's really about you. And I think it's also very empowering to think, like, people want to hear what I have to say. Also a cliche that no one in their teenage years feels like anyone cares about them or anyone cares about what they have to say is important. After you've told the story, it's so awesome to feel like you're relatable. Because, like, most of the time you kind of think, like, my life is pretty boring and no one understands me. You know, like, classic teen angst, like, oh, no one gets me. But, like, this time, like, not only do people get you, but you can feel the audience getting you. And it's not just people in your age group. It's people who are a lot older than you. It's people who are a lot younger than you. It's your teachers. It's your fellow students. Like, people you never thought you could connect with. Like, they get it. There isn't a space in the American education system or in extracurriculars where this kind of expression exists. And I think it's obviously very much desired. And it's awesome to be a part of. So I think that's why high schoolers are really drawn to it. Because when you're an adult, you can talk to people about this kind of stuff. But when you're a kid, like, this isn't exactly like common conversation topic. You know, this is something that you really only get one chance to say.
Here from a Moth Shop showcase, Shawit Zirai.
So I have a lot of siblings. I have 8. So I can kind of pick and choose which ones I like, which ones I don't like. And my favorite sibling has always been my brother, Sennai. And Sennai is 22 years old now, and he's 5 years older than I am, and he's this hilarious guy. You know, he's, like, funny, he's smart, he's beautiful. He's, like, just a great kid. He's kind of, like, the perfect kid. And people would always come up to me when I was younger and be like, aren't you really jealous of Sennai? Because I was always kind of like the second prettiest, like the second smartest, like I can never really meet him. And I was like, why would I be jealous of Sennai? Like, he's the best guy in the world. I was really glad he existed. And my mother and I don't agree on a lot of things, but one thing we agreed on was that Sennai was the perfect child. He was like, I can't even explain what he is. He's amazing. So one day when I was 10 years old, my brother was 15, he sat me down and he was like, Shawit, I have a secret. And I was like, okay, like, cool, he's going to share stuff with me. I'm really psyched. Like, I like learning about him. And he sits me down and he looks at me and he says, Shawit, I'm gay. And I didn't really know what gay was. I was 10. And the only time I'd ever heard the word gay was coming from my mother's mouth. And my mother is a staunch Catholic. She's very traditional, very conservative, grew up in this tiny village in this little part of Africa called Eritrea, and she just, to her, gay was on par with being a murderer. She'd only associated it, I'd heard of it, like, if you're gay, you're going to hell. If you're gay, you're sinning. Like, that's how I grew up. To me, gay was just this disgusting thing you couldn't touch. And hearing this from my perfect brother telling me, Shawit, I'm gay, my mind went to two places, you know, one, how, what? And the other that ended up dominating was, here's my perfect brother, here's this man that I love telling me he's gay. If Sennai's gay, gay can't be bad. So I was like, okay, Sennai, like, you're gay, that's cool. Like, I'm here for you, like, I'm here for you. And he looks at me and he says, Shawit, don't tell our mother. It was the most terrifying look on his face. Like, if you tell our mother, help me God, I am dead. And I was like, I would never, like, oh my gosh, like, don't even worry about it, like, I got you. I'm 10 years old here, like, being like, I'm gonna protect my older brother. So 3 years pass, and I'm 13 years old, and I get into Trinity, which is a good high school, and my brother gets into NYU on full scholarship, which is crazy, because, like, he's kind of the first sibling to go to a good college, and, you know, the house was, like, this, like, bubble of joy, like, it was just awesome time for all of us. And I remember standing in the kitchen one night with my brother, Fatawi, who's 2 years older than I am, and my mom. And, you know, we're speaking in Arabic because that's the language we speak. and I get this really sinking feeling in my stomach, like something terrible is about to happen, and I can't stop it. So, you know, I sit there and I keep talking, and my brother looks at me, and he looks at my mom, and he says, "Mommy, Sanae's gay." And in Arabic, there isn't a word for gay, so he has to say, "Mom, Sanae is a boy who likes boys." And she doesn't really get it at first. She looks at me, and I look away, and she looks at my brother, and he says it again in English, "Sanae is gay." And at the drop of that word gay, she just kind of breaks down, and just the tension in the room just snaps, and I don't know what to do, you know? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, what did you just do? You know, I'm not saying anything. I'm just silent, terrified, and my first thought is, I have to go save Sanae. Like, I have to go find him. And so I run into my room, and he's sitting on my bed, and we share a room, and I'm just like, "Sanae, something terrible happened." And he's like, "Sweet, what happened?" And I'm like, "Vitaly told mommy you're gay." And he's like, "What? Like, why would he do that?" And he was terrified, and I was terrified. And, you know, he starts to throw his stuff in a bag, and he starts to put on his jacket, and I see him doing this. So I throw my stuff in a bag, and I put on a jacket. And we're just, it's crazy, it's hectic, we're terrified. And then all of a sudden, he just looks at me, and he's standing in the doorway getting ready to leave, and I'm ready to leave. And he's just like, "Where do you think you're going?" And I'm like, I'm going to go with you. Like, where else would I go? Like, I belong with you." And he's just like, "No, like, this isn't your battle. This isn't your fight. You're too young. You know, your place is here with your mother." And I was like, "I don't want to be here. I want to be with you. Like, I want to save you. I want to be with you." And he's just like, "No, stay." And he slams the door in my face. And I just kind of collapse on my bed thinking, like, what just happened? So Sanae leaves, and he never comes back. He comes back to pick up clothing. My mother disowns him the same day. And he ends up living with his friend till he goes away to college. And I'm stuck at home. So the next 2, 3, 4, 5 till now, really, it's kind of like a war zone, especially the next month afterwards. And my mother and I had never really been on good terms, but it was kind of now as explosive terms. It was like every little thing, every night I would scream, every night she would scream. And I was a really complacent child. I was really the good kid, like got good grades, you know, obedient, clean the house. But this time I was beyond fury. Like this woman had taken away like the one thing in my life I had loved. And I could not like feel anything toward this woman except for black. She wasn't even my mother. It was just black hatred 24/7. I couldn't look at her without being disgusted. And it was a really bad time for my mother and I. And I remember sitting in my room one day, my mother's at church, and I'm staring in the mirror doing my like daily, you know, like, "I hate you, mom, I hate you, mom, I hate you, mom." Like, just staring at the mirror doing that. It's about a month after the incident. And I'm thinking, I have to get revenge for my brother. Like, I have to do something to break this woman's heart. I have to make her feel what I felt. And I used to have really nice hair, and it used to come up to about here, and it was like long and really pretty and curly. And this is unusual because I'm African-American, and usually African-Americans have pretty kinky hair. Everyone in my family has kinky hair, but for some reason I was blessed with really pretty long hair. And it was my mother's pride and joy. Like, she loved it, and I loved it, to be honest. But she loved it more than I did. It was just, she just loved it a lot. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be crazy if I just cut off all of my hair? Like, that would enrage her. So, you know, I tie my hair into pigtails, and I take I take scissors, and I just chop them off. And needless to say, it looks ridiculous because I chopped them off unevenly. So it was kind of like, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I'm still angry, and I look at myself, and I get angrier because I'm like, this isn't enough. Like, she's not going to feel what I felt. So I opened my closet, and I went to Catholic school, so I didn't have a lot of street clothing, but what little clothes I did have was really colorful, you know, white, because my mother hated the color black. It was just a disgusting color. We weren't allowed to own any clothing in black. So I was like, wouldn't also just enrage my mother if I dyed all of my clothes black? So I run out to the store, to the 99-cent store. I buy like 6 boxes of iodine dye. I don't really know what I'm doing, so I kind of just take it back home. And I fill up my bathtub with water, and I just dump all of this dye in the bathtub, dyeing my bathtub black. And I take all of my clothing, including my uniform, and I kind of just swish it in this water and like poke it with a stick for a while and like wait for it to turn black. I ruin all the clothes. And I take out my Catholic school uniform, and I put it on, dripping wet, you know, staining my body, staining the floor, staining the couch. And I sit down, and I proceed to wait for my mother to come home from church. And I'm just sitting there with this crazy hair and this, like, ridiculous outfit, just dripping wet, just waiting. And the door turns, and my mother comes in.
She looks at me. And she doesn't say anything. And she starts to cry. And it's not the sobbing that I see from my mother. It's not this wrathful anger that I see from my mother. It's this deep place of sorrow and loss, and I can't place it, and I can't respond to it. So I start to cry. And it's just this terrible exchange of broken hearts, and I can't even deal. And I've kind of come to realize now that my mother had held Sennai to such a high state, such a high expectation, to like this level that couldn't be reached, perfection. That's how we all held him. And so when he was gay, he kind of fell from this high up place. I mean, you're so high up, you have so far to fall. And my mother loved him more than she loved any of us. My mother loved him more than I loved him. I can't even comprehend that kind of love. So at the end of the day, it wasn't that my mother didn't love Sennai enough. It was that she loved him too much. Thank you.
That was Shuit Zarai. When she told this story, Shuit was a junior in high school. I sat down to talk with Shuit about what this storytelling process was like.
I think when I told it to my school community, it was very nerve-wracking, and I was afraid because I'm generally known as a very quiet person. Like, not quiet, but a very private person. And the response was, I don't know, it was, like, really intense. Like, people were, like, crying afterwards, and I was like, I didn't want to do that. Like, that's not – I don't want to deal with you crying at 8:15 in the morning, which is a little cold, but, like, I had school that day. Like, I had the rest of my day. But it was very surprising because Trinity isn't exactly known for being, like, an emotionally supportive place. It's pretty much it's a really rigorous academic school. We don't have time to cry. So that was really, like, pleasant almost. And also the teacher's response, like, there were a lot of teachers who, like, pulled me aside and, like, hugged me for, like, a solid 5 minutes. And I was like, I am okay, but thank you. Like, that's nice. Like, teachers who don't teach me. Teacher, I don't even know their names. So that was really cool. And I think, like, it definitely, like, I did not think of any of the things I'm saying now about my mother and, like, perspective and trying to see things from her side. I did not think them when I was 13. I didn't think them when I was a freshman. I didn't think them until last year, until while I was workshopping the story. Especially when we were talking about endings and, like, what's your last line going to be and what impression do you want to leave the audience with. And I definitely knew initially it was just going to be a story of revenge, like a really, like, the audience would leave disliking my mother. And then as I kind of workshopped the story and thought about it, I realized, like, I really don't want that impression on them because I don't dislike my mother at this, like, I may have disliked her then, but I love her a lot now, and I want people to leave knowing how much she loves us and how much I love her, because I feel like it'd be a disrespect to her to tell the story, and it would be dishonest.
To hear more of this interview with Shuit, and for information on our community storytelling workshops, go to themoth.org. To share any of the stories you've heard this hour, go to themoth.org, where you can stream the stories for free and send a link to your friends and family. While you're there, you can also pitch us your story, record it right on our site, or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. The best pitches are developed for Moth shows all around the country. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll join us next time, and that's the story from The Moth.
Your host this hour was Sarah Austin Jeunesse. Sarah also directed the stories in the hour along with Catherine Burns and Larry Rosen. The rest of The Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman, Jennifer Hickson, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Echter. Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour, R2-D2 from Bilk, New York by Cat Power, and Struggle by Bill Frisell. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for links to the music we use in our show, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.